The following is Harry Max's closing keynote, leading across channels from the 2012 Information Architecture Summit. The 2012 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering and the UIE Virtual Seminar Program. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
Wow, I did not expect to see this many people here at this time with this kind of weather after last night. This is pretty impressive. So that makes me a little nervous. So first off, just a quick shout out to Jay Morgan. Jay has been helping me put this together. It's been a lot of work the last couple of days, and he's just done a fantastic job. So I really appreciate you all being here. I mean, it's stunning. I mean, I watched the community grow over a long period of time. When I stepped into the community, I had been behind the scenes doing a lot of information architecture related stuff. And somebody said, you know, there are other people doing this, and they're hanging out in Asilomar, and you should go hang out with them too. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. Okay. So I went down there, and I met Christina, and had a whole pile of you guys down there. And it began a very interesting conversation about speaking the language of business and trying to figure out what the relationship between IA and experience design was. And it just sort of led to me showing up at these year after year after year, as long as I could. And now here I am in front of a very large room of people. So let me begin with a quick story. The first time I realized there was a serious problem, I was in third grade. I was standing in Mrs. Schwichtenberg's class. She had jet black hair, big thick glasses, and we got to do this thing called a duck and cover exercise. I mean, most of you guys don't know what those are, I suspect, because you're all too young, but I'm one of the old farts, so. A duck and cover exercise, if you haven't been through one, is in the event of a 1 megaton nuclear bomb, you dive under your desk. Well, right before you do that, you close the curtain so you're not blinded by the light. And then you dive under the desk, and then when it's all over, they put you on a bus and they drive you far away. And I went to elementary school in Malibu at the time, and so we were supposed to go through this exercise and get on a bus and go to Ventura. And I came home and I told my father. So I'm like, Dad, well, this is not your ordinary dad. My dad's a thermonuclear theoretical plasma physicist, right? His specialty. His specialty is in test and measurement of thermonuclear explosions. And so I said, Dad, this is really amazing. We had to go up and close these big giant curtains which look out over the Pacific. And then we dove under our desks and they said in the event of a 1 megaton nuclear bomb that we would then get out of the classroom and we'd get on the bus and they would drive us to Ventura. And my father said, Son, the Russians don't have anything that small. I was like, what? And he said, oh yeah, all their missiles, their ICBMs, are tri-tip 20 megaton nuclear weapons. He said, there won't be a bus. And at that moment, I started to realize that what I was learning wasn't exactly right. So I'm sure there are things now that you believe that you didn't believe before, and I'm sure there are things that you used to believe that you now know are bunk. Well, some of what I've been learning over the last couple of years sort of fits into that. Each of us is more or less aware that we operate as agents of change in the work that we do. We do this in our own lives as we evolve and grow. We do this in our organizations. And we do this in the discipline of information architecture and experience design. I mean, I'm still stunned to see people call it user experience because, well, we'll talk about that later. So why does this matter? It matters because I think we're kind of at a crossroads, in a sense. On one hand, people say they don't know where the discipline is going. You know, is IA being gobbled up? Ooh. You know, and on the other hand, look at the people in here. I mean, this is amazing. I mean, I don't know what the actual numbers have been over the year, but this feels like a discipline that's growing to me, not one that's shrinking. Is information architecture losing its identity? So, fundamentally, this isn't a pep talk. It's really a serious challenge, and I'm here to talk to you about what I've been doing and how what I've been doing is changing how people perceive information architecture and experience design. And while I'm currently the VP of Experience Design at Rackspace, I've done, you know, a bunch of interesting things. Started out with sort of the design and the development of the shopping cart that went on to work at Hewlett-Packard. I've done a bunch of other stuff that Jess has mentioned as well. But I want to challenge you in a sense. I want to challenge you to think about 5 tools of change that, you know, on fairly deep reflection, I have been using intimately in the work that I've been doing over the last couple of years. And I wanted to share those with you, each of which I'll talk about in more detail. One is illuminating. Two is educating. Three is negotiating. Four is advocating. And five is activating. I think we have a huge, huge opportunity right now. First, as individuals, for ourselves. Next, on our teams and in our organizations. And finally, for the practice at large. You know, we create the world through our imagination and our visions, our conversations, our decisions, our commitments, and our actions. And it's essential that you understand that you're actually creating the world. Right? You have tons of choice. And where we have choice is in each moment, in the now. Each moment we get to choose our attitudes, how thoughtfully we listen, and what do we do with the information that we get. The opportunities to get better at choosing, because our choices contribute directly to the reality as it unfolds, right smack in front of us. I think of this in a sense as kind of, there's a default reality, and then there's the one that we're creating. And the default reality is one possible version of reality, but it's not a given. I think we have a lot of choice. The Russians don't have anything that small. Is there any purpose in closing the curtains? There's no bus, right? What is it that, how do we respond when we're being told things? And how do we listen? And what do we do with that information? And what I'm trying to say is, essentially, some of you argue that we're change agents, and others say we're not, but either way, you're an agent of change in your own life. You have choice. I hear that design, experience design, user-centered design, service design, information design thinking, and all the monikers of the form of the word design will change the world. But in effect, I think that's only part right. I think we've, to some extent, overpromised, and I think, to some extent, we're under-delivering. I think, in a way, we're target fixated on the wrong problem. You know, this concept of target fixation, I don't know, have any of you learned to fly a plane, like the kind that go in the air? Raise your hand if you have. Okay? I love metaphors of planes and cars. When you learn to fly, your flight instructor will always tell you to look for the open space. Look for the open space. So what does that mean? So at 2,000 feet, 300 miles an hour, if your engine's cut out and your plane is on an unplanned glide path out of the sky, heading to the ground, part of your job is to keep your eye fixated on the place where the mountain is not, where the rocks are not, where the water is not. Your job is to constantly scan for, identify, and fixate on the place you might be able to land. Because if you look at the thing that scares you, that's where you're going. The cool thing is you can use target fixation to your advantage. You keep your eyes on where you want to land, look for the open space. Design is a craft of change, and the potential is there. But I worry that not everybody realizes just how much choice or agency we have in the process of landing the plane where it is that we have an open space. So we react to the default reality instead of creating a better one. If design can solve all of these problems, don't we need to model the behavior as design thinkers and doers? So part of your job is to lead change, and Gandhi said it best, right? You must be the change you want to see in the world. Simple as that. Whether you like it or not, each of us is agents of change, and change follows in your wake, right? The wake you leave is a version of reality you choose to live in. Your first opportunity is to shed light. I had this originally characterized as your first responsibility, but I heard people were getting uppity about being told what to do. So I decided to call it an opportunity. So if I stumble over any of these words that might not have been changed in the last 4 hours, I apologize in advance. I'm not trying to tell you what to do. I think you all know how to do your jobs, right? I mean, the message here is there are things that I'm doing that seem to be working, and they're generating enormous change. And I think it's maybe my inability to recognize that the default reality is the one I'm supposed to be in is the thing that's allowing me to continue to move forward. So you know the story, right? One night a man goes out drinking at a local bar. He's in a good mood, drinks a lot, gets hammered. Some of you can attest to this, right? As he begins walking home, singing happily to himself, he pulls his keys out. As he's getting near his apartment, he takes his keys out of his pocket and he drops them on the ground in the dark, right? So, on realizing his keys are missing, he wanders over to a nearby streetlight and begins looking for them. 10 minutes later, a policeman comes by and sees the man and says, "Sir, what are you doing?" To which he responds, "I'm looking for my keys." "Where did you drop them?" says the policeman. "Oh, over there, on the dark side of the street," says the drunk. The policeman looks pretty puzzled. "If you dropped your keys over there in the dark, why are you looking for them over here under the street lamp?" "Well, because," says the drunk, "there's more light here." Well, I want to take you down a weird little path for a minute. So you recall that Einstein said the definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over and expect a different result. Let me ask you guys a question. What word best describes the following? A series of decisions and actions where the result is the opposite of the intended outcome, where willful ignorance or self-deception is at play.
Lie.
You cheated. It's the wrong answer. So I have a somewhat pejorative word I use for this, and I apologize to those of you who feel like you might be implicated, but I call it stupidity, right? Whenever I talk to people about stupidity, it's just this, I'm my own best subject, right? It's interesting to me to see the kinds of stuff I do. And whenever I talk to people about it, I always get one of two reactions. Either people laugh, they ask questions, and I have a really interesting conversation, or they look really nervous and they walk away. I think the interesting thing is that knowing how to think about stupidity rationally gives us a way to solve for it. It gives us a new tool for looking at what's not working and how to fix it. So according to Jonah Lehrer, I don't know how many of you guys have read How We Decide, our emotional subsystem is what really allows us to make decisions. It's not really our rational mind. I mean, our rational mind is awfully useful and it's excellent for creating perfect justifications of what we've just done, but our actual decision-making apparatus is enabled by our emotional subsystem. So one place to be particularly mindful is making sure you don't brush aside your feelings. The reason? Perceptions are facts for people. We all know that. It's part of our jobs. So brushing aside your feelings is a form of willful ignorance. And the result is, well, it depends, right? Ultimately, the facts, including your own sense of what's true, is feelings. The facts just are. They're friendly. I mean, the facts don't have any intrinsic meaning. They just are. Nothing more. So as a result, if you deal with the facts as they are and not as they should be, then you dramatically increase the chances that you're going to get an outcome that you're looking for. Self-deception's not entirely bad, though, right? I mean, it's highly functional in two important ways, right? One, right? Self-deception's a perfect way to go about your life happily and not think about the fact that you're going to die, right? Another way is that self-deception is like the perfect tool for conjuring up some new app or new hardware device or new company or whatever and breathe life into it by going and convincing people that they ought to help you build it, putting it on Kickstarter, talking to a VC, whatever, getting it funded, and then selling it to customers who are willing and able to pay for it. So part of your job in turning up the light is to get what you want, and it's to help our organizations get what they want, and it's to help the discipline itself evolve. So as a personal example to make this more real, because sometimes this stuff gets a little abstract, let me share with you a very short personal story of a time when it became clear to me I had to illuminate a whole lot better. So I'd been, 2 months ago, I'd been at Rackspace a year, and I thought, okay, I should probably get some feedback and figure out if I'm doing okay. For any of you who have been an executive, you probably know that you figure out if you're not doing okay the day after your card reader doesn't work, right? You get really crappy feedback when you're operating at the level of executive. You have to be very, very thoughtful about listening to people and hearing what kind of information you're getting and watching what's going on, because the 360 reviews, nobody's telling you the truth. They're all scared. So I thought to myself, self, there has to be a better way. So I went and picked the people that I was interacting with and where the potential for high friction was, and I just very gently choreographed conversations with each of them until I got a couple of really kick-ass pieces of feedback. And one of the pieces of feedback blew me away. This guy, my design lead, he's awesome. We would be nowhere without him. Bestica, keep your ears shut. He's awesome. And I said, so, I'm not going to tell you his name now because I realize you're here. So I said, so we've been working through some really, really tough problems. Is there anything that I could do better? Anything I should do more of? Anything I should do less of? If you had a magic wand and you could change one thing I'm doing and you walked in tomorrow morning and it was different, what would it be? And he said, well, for me personally, nothing. But here's what I hear from people. He said, you know, you are a very convincing guy, and you're smart. And when you talk to people about some idea you have or some project you want them to start, you get in a room and you whiteboard and you create all these crazy ideas and you have this fabulous conversation. It all makes perfect sense for about 20 minutes. After they leave the room, they don't know what you said or what they're supposed to do or how they're supposed to approach it, and they feel like idiots, and they don't come back because they're afraid. It's like, you've got to be kidding me. I'm not scary. And they said, well, you're kind of scary. And I thought of my dad, of course, who was kind of scary. And I thought, well, what am I going to do, right? How is it that I'm behaving like the math professor I feared, right? My theoretical plasma physicist father who tried to teach me calculus when I was 9. That didn't work. And it was awful. And he would say something, it made sense, and I would leave, and it would not make sense. I went to math class, they would make sense, I would leave, I couldn't do the homework, right? And now I've got people working for me who are saying the same thing about me. And I'm thinking, okay. So I tried a couple of things out. And I said, well, how about this? How about, I have a particular format that I use for making requests. And I said, how about if after these meetings are done, if I had a request, I make it in that format? And how about if there were any drawings in the room, I capture those on my own camera and I share those back and then maybe quick annotation of whatever went on in the meeting. And he was like, oh my God, that would solve the problem. And I said, you know, it feels a little unfair, right, that I have to do all the work. And he goes, yeah, but it's their responsibility too. And I thought to myself, yeah, but it's 100% my responsibility if I want to live in a different world. It wasn't that I needed to turn the light up in the moment. It's that I needed to shine the flashlight further out for people and help them see where it was I wanted us to go together. So beyond turning up the light inside yourself, I believe you get there by practicing your art: visualization, categorization, information design, interaction dynamics, symbolic structure development. I mean, all these cool things that we can do. When we talk about turning up the light outside, one key idea of illuminating is capturing transient ideas. And this is one of the things that I've noticed is really powerful, is that these things, we seem to have a gift to be able to take these transient moments that people have, these conversations that people are having, and turn them into frameworks or pictures or diagrams and make them visual for people, make them real. And it becomes part of the relevant conversation as it goes forward. I mean, maybe it's visualizing the flow of money in your organization, because some organizations are really, the way the money works is really complicated. But think about it. I mean, what diagrams or posters or pictures or infographics have you seen that made you think, damn, I wish I had done that? And I've seen those. I realize in one of the talks, whose was it? Ah, I digress. So someone took the time to reveal the meaning for other people. I mean, it helps shape reality itself when these things exist, because it creates a new piece of the de facto reality. And it helps facilitate relevant conversations. It helps us make better decisions. It helps us align our action better. So work big and work visual. And when you trip over something that needs to be captured and presented, take it upon yourself to create a persistent artifact and blow it up. So, of course, you have to remember my father, right, the guy who knows about explosions. I mean, his briefcase was a dual-lined detonator case, and he had a handcuff on it. And so I would, you know, I think I was probably in ninth grade, I started taking up photography, maybe it was eighth grade, I took up photography, right? I was the coolest thing ever. I did my own Cibachrome color printing, and, you know, it was awesome. I worked on Kodachrome 25, which you can't even buy anymore. And I would bring a picture to him, and I would say, "Dad, look at my blow-up." And he would say, "Son, that's not a blow-up. That's an enlargement." So freeze reality where you can. In this light, educating is about the development of skills and capability and knowledge. And it involves learning what we need to learn, teaching what our organizations need to know, and bringing the learnings to our discipline in the form of case studies, stories, examples. And ultimately, it's about doing what I'm here doing right now. Scared as I am to stand in front of a crowd of fellow practitioners, you know, it's about changing behavior. I mean, we can't really teach each other well until we have a clue how to do these things ourselves. And we can't model the new behaviors until we've actually internalized them. And this is what I call training people by accident is. I mean, it's modeling the behavior you want to see in your preferred version of the world. One of my mentors, who's now 84 years old, Richard Bowles, I don't know if any of you know him, he wrote the book, What Color Is Your Parachute? He categorizes skills and capabilities into three sort of super categories. One is domain-specific skills like card sorting in our world, basic transferable skills like typing, and personal adaptive skills, which are kind of the soft skills. Most people don't pay enough attention to personal adaptive skills like precision questioning and precision answering, active listening, decision making, effective negotiation. These are the tools of the agents of change. The opportunity is for you to educate yourself, to learn what's necessary to do the work, sure. And from there, you can educate teams of people who will really understand the problem with you and who will work to develop better solutions going forward. For me, educating others means giving people simple frameworks and tools like PQ&A, or precision questioning and answering, which I can model and then use, and then they can model for others to use. I push people to do outcome-based thinking and to do heavy current state analysis and to do visual road mapping in the Dave Sibbett style, because these are the things that essentially create a higher fidelity version of the default reality. And it's amazing to see what happens when people start asking better questions and giving more relevant, succinct answers, because it moves the conversation forward. Tools like these transform your ability to get stuff done and to interact more effectively across your organization. You want the overall organization to see what you see and to understand what you understand and use design thinking to solve tough problems. Setting priorities, making trade-offs, funding projects, canceling others, it's all about negotiation. At some point, we shift from illuminating and educating to trying to get stuff done. But if it were only about you, it would be a snap, right? When other people are involved, it almost always means finding some form of compromise, whether it's at home or whether it's at work. Dealing with other people means talking about what you want to accomplish. But they want to get stuff done too. Different perspectives often means different needs, different interests, different goals. So it's about harmonizing your needs, interests, and goals with their needs and interests and goals. It's about bringing perspectives together in a way that allow you to move from conversation to commitment and from commitment to action. To start, we need to develop the skill of asking precision questions and giving precise answers, because it allows the conversation or the story to move forward. We need to learn to say no in ways that empower us to keep the conversations moving forward so we can get to the bigger yes. Learning to negotiate is key. The trick is getting more intentional and figuring out how to use the ability to change perceptual position, to see through somebody else's eyes and to understand their feelings, and to do it in a way that allows you to figure out what questions you should be asking and help them understand what they need to be asking of you. Negotiation includes problem solving. And the first part of problem solving is characterizing the situation. You know, I've had, I don't know, probably a dozen conversations here where this has come up this week since Wednesday, where somebody said, "Well, you know what the problem is?" And the first thing I think of is, it's not just one problem. The second thing I think of is, well, in that particular instance, it's a predicament. You can't solve that problem, because it's not a problem to be solved. So whether it's a problem that can't be solved or a predicament that can't be solved or a quagmire where every attempt to solve it leaves you worse off or a challenge where you have a chance to win or an opportunity, a set of valuable potential, unlimited possibilities, understanding and characterizing the situation you're involved in and how you're going to negotiate with people is profoundly helpful. Because if you're in a predicament, it is not useful to negotiate. But you have to be honest with yourself about who you are and about who you are in your organization and about what role you have in whatever relationship you're in. You also have to help others see and tease out the criteria for sufficiency. What's good enough? You know, what would be just barely okay? And what are the criteria for sufficiency? What would be hopelessly idealistic beyond our imagination? How would we know if we had a version of reality that was kick-ass awesome? What would we see? What would we feel? What would we hear? What would we read? See through their eyes and help them discover what questions to ask. I mean, negotiating implies a relationship and partnership, and as each party discovers what questions to ask, they discover how to get their needs met. And this transforms the conversation from a battle to a game or a treasure hunt. The goal is to achieve something collectively and collaboratively in order to reach the treasure or prize. And when I'm negotiating at work, I often hear myself saying, you know, what you're working on is super important. What I'm working on is super important too. We have to work together to get to a great place, a place where we want to go. I think the real trick is being mindful about how we get there and not turning it into a battle of wills or a zero-sum game. And I think authentic self-confidence is fundamentally the key. And I believe the responsibilities or opportunities I've discussed so far prepare us for observing, getting oriented, and bringing us to the brink of deciding. But it's right at that moment that we get in our own way. Somewhere deep inside each of us is a joyful yes and a feisty no. And only you can decide which is which. Joy is yes, regret is no. At the point you have to decide, at the very moment you have to choose, that's what you get, a yes or a no. Each negotiation is filled with yeses and nos, and the trick is knowing which one is which and not overriding the feeling that you have that's telling you exactly what to do. The feeling is information you need to negotiate. It's a form of internal compass. So what do you trust to move forward? Well, to begin with, you have to trust yourself. That's where it starts. You can't trust yourself if you're willfully deceiving yourself. You have to trust the data, and the data is the feeling. Choice is in the moment, right here, and activation is putting the motive force behind that. But I'll talk about that in a minute. So the good news is that decisions go through natural stages, and using a simple decision-making framework will put a stop to important decisions getting undone. I see this over and over and over. There are 5 simple steps to moving reality forward when it comes to decision-making. And this eliminates the slippage that happens when decisions get undone, and it prevents us from having to have the same old tired conversations over and over again. You start with conversations and you make sure the right stakeholders are involved. We all know how to do that. We know how to do stakeholder identification, stakeholder analysis. We know how to have great conversations. We know how to listen. We know how to ask good questions. Then what? Most people go straight to either action or they go straight to a decision. But actually there's a step, there are a couple of steps in between. Right? You go from conversations to provisional decision. This is the decision you think you're gonna make. And then you make sure that that provisional decision is actually the decision that you're gonna make. You slow the whole process down. And when you're sure that that provisional decision is the decision you're going to make, you move to the actual decision. And then you share with people what the decision is. And you see what kind of feedback you get. And you see how you feel about it as well. And from there, you actually get the decision ratified. So you slow decision down, and you break it apart, and you turn it into 3 things. Decision becomes provisional decision, and ratified decision. And from there, you get to action. And I love the picture of the roller coaster, because you know when you're going up the roller coaster, it goes clank, 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 clank. You know, and you think, thank God for those things. They prevent me from going backward. That's what this is. It's a way of clank, 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 provisional decision, clank, 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 decision, clank, 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 ratified decision. And then you act. And that way, if something fails, it clicks back to a point that you can then be safe and stop and renegotiate and go forward. There's a discovery-driven element to this, and one of the best resources that I've bumped into so far, and I recommend this to a lot of folks, is The Power of Positive No. I don't know if you folks have read that. It's really good. And it's really about how you get to the bigger yes by saying no. There are also other resources as well. There are a number of other resources. Jim Camp has a negotiation school. And man, if you guys haven't read some of the great books on negotiation, like Bargaining for Advantage or Getting More by Stuart Diamond, man, learn how to negotiate. It's awesome. I mean, it just changes everything. So there's an element to being right here, right now, and knowing how to say no with grace, allowing people, including yourself, to be part of the story as the story unfolds. So let me talk about activation for a minute. I know you're warm, and I know I'm talking a lot.
But the AC's not noisy.
So the term activation I draw from a book called Now Discover Your Strengths by Donald Clifton and Marcus Buckingham. Really cool book. Strengths are like talents. They're ways of thinking about and behaving. They're things that come easily to you, either things that you do or ways that you process information that just sort of are natural to you, and they're sort of probably not necessarily natural for somebody else in the same way. They're easy. They put you in a flow state when you're there. And activation is very interesting. The concept of activator is, here's part of the definition, right? When can we start? You are impatient for action. Only action is real. Only action can make things happen. Only action leads to performance. Once a decision is made, you cannot not act. So it feels like negotiation happens and then activation happens. Activate is about saying yes and getting stuff done, and it's about getting beyond the conversations and getting beyond the commitments and moving into action. And it's about doing the work, and it's also about being the change that you want to see. So to win the hearts and minds of those who depend on us as agents of change, we not only need to do the work that we do, but we need to model the process, share the tools, provide the templates and the artifacts, and set higher standards. In effect, we get to design where we want to go and know what to leave behind and lead others as we discover on the path forward ourselves. And this means not only activating ourselves, our teams, and our organizations, but it means activating this discipline, which is what you guys are doing. So we start by creating a new vision of possibility, and we give others the power to participate in creating the kind of world we want to live in. You see, our work reveals how things can change. Information architecture, experience design, design thinking, visualization, this is what we do. Our art is making this real and concrete and valuable. Activation is the ignition switch. The point is this: activate proactively. Why? When you don't activate proactively, you lose control of the timeline. You lose control of the choices you have now, and you're forced to react. When you lose control of the timeline, you're forced to react to the default reality, a reality that others created, and not necessarily by design. Create the reality you want to live in. Don't wait for others to tell you what to do, how to think, what to build, how to work. Activate, and activate proactively. At this moment, I'm advocating pretty heavily. I'm advocating for us to get better. I'm advocating not inquiring, which is asking questions. I'm advocating not empathizing, That would be relating to your feelings and your perspectives right about now. Advocating is not listening. You're doing that, not me. Listening with an open mind and open heart. Advocating right now is what I'm doing. I'm talking. I'm trying to make a couple of points. The challenge most of us face is that we don't know when we're advocating. As information architects and designers, we're trained to listen, to ask good questions, and empathize. But we're not actually trained well to advocate effectively, to effectively communicate what we need and want. And in the work we do, it's essential that you advocate for yourself, for your projects, and for your team. It's not only about getting credit where credit is due when you do the hard work. It's about putting yourself out there, knowing what to say, when to say it, and how to say it so the right people will listen and act on your behalf and on behalf of the things you see that need to be done. It's about advocating for the user, your stakeholders, and for user experience, experience design, information architecture as well. If people don't know who you are, what you're capable of, what value you create, and how you can make things better just by showing up, then everybody loses. So I think it's essential that we advocate for better experiences across all channels, up and down the interaction chain. Part of our job is to help people see that what shows up in an interface is only part, a small piece of the puzzle. So part of our job is to help people see where they participate in this puzzle. Our job is to thread the needle through the interface, from the business model, through the service design interactions, and experience moments, and ultimately the user interface, regardless of who the user happens to be. End user, pre-sales engagement, post-sales support, developers, or employees. For the discipline at large, it's not about the user anymore. Besides, when I hear the word user, I still think a crack addict. That's not who I'm designing for. I mean, there may be people doing it, but it's not me. To me, it's about personas and atomic segments in an omni-channel world. And as I see it, limiting our understanding to users doesn't take into account the interaction change that lead to high utility design and extraordinary value for value exchanges. We have to connect this stuff all the way back because great interfaces aren't enough anymore. We have to link this stuff deep into the organization. Who else is going to do it? So Rackspace recruited me to help build a product generation capability by creating an experience design practice alongside engineering, QE, and product management. It's been a daunting challenge. In just over a year, we've built a formidable product organization to deliver a next-generation public cloud by illuminating, shedding light, educating, learning, and helping others learn. Negotiating, compromising, collaborating, activating, getting it done, and being the change that we want to see. Advocating, taking the time to talk about what matters. So these are the things I've been doing. And these are the things I'm asking you to take some time and think about. We have a huge opportunity in front of us. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We have time for just a few questions. So Jared Spool has kindly volunteered to help run mic with me. He gives good mic. Hey, I'm holding the mic too. If you have a question, just raise your hand and we'll get a mic to you.
In your talk, you negotiate and advocate did seem to sort of slip together. Do you think you could maybe just parse them out a little bit for us, for me?
Advocating is not about making compromises. Advocating is not about seeing the world through somebody else's eyes and trying to understand how to get their needs met, their interests met, their goals met. It's not about harmonizing, getting your needs and their needs met, your goals and their goals met. Advocating is about saying what needs to be said, independent of making a compromise.
Hi, thanks for that. It was very coherent. I like this pulling together feeling. It's, you know, it's good. How do you feel about terms like conceptual integrity and situational awareness?
I would love it if I could find it.
Okay.
I don't know what else to say. I mean, these are big concepts, and I think they're super important, and I think we have to figure out how to make them real and concrete for ourselves, and how to pursue reaching them through the work that we're doing. But again, I think it's a journey.
Thank you.
Hey, Harry, that was great. I want to thank you for talking about information architecture at an information architecture conference. Not that that's the only thing anybody should ever talk about, but I'm saying that this year especially, it feels to me like, and I don't know if people missed it because, you know, you gave it in such a calm, quiet, and deliberate way, but what you're saying is actually kind of radical, because what you're getting at is that these deep connections into the business or into the communities or the people that we're making things for, those deep connections, the only way we can affect them is by finding the place that you're talking about finding in ourselves and getting the skills that you're talking about getting, and that those are as important, probably more important, than knowing how to card sort.
Yeah.
And so in case anybody missed it, because it took me a few minutes to get there myself, was I went, oh my God, because in my own job, this is where I've ended up, is most of what I do in order to get the design, the structures, and the frameworks to actually see the light of day is all the stuff you're talking about. So I guess I'm just repeating what you said, but I'm also wondering, like, I mean, do you see, how has that merged for you? You know, like, do you even see a difference anymore between those skills and the how-to skills of the craft?
I hold them in the same esteem, but I hold them in separate categories. And so for me, working on my own personal and professional development, these kind of personal adaptive skills are in their own swim lane of things that I want to develop. And I invest in them as part of a portfolio, and I keep them separate from the other things to make sure that they are getting a disproportionate amount of my time and energy.
I have a follow-up for that, which is...
I invest in them as part of a portfolio, and I keep them separate from the other things to make sure that they are getting a disproportionate amount of my time and energy.
I have a follow-up for that, which is, are you also looking at your reports, your direct reports, your indirect reports, and looking at their development of those skills?
Yes.
And that's how might that manifest?
That's the cheeky answer. So the fair answer is that I am spending an extraordinary amount of my own personal time to develop a capability maturity model for these skills, because I believe they are crucial to getting where it is we want to go, where I want to go personally, where the folks that are working with me want to go, where our teams actually want to go. I've hired a learning architect to start codifying these things into training programs and deploying them throughout Rackspace, and where the company wants to go. Because for me, Rackspace is growing very, very fast, and fast-growing companies have to invest very heavily in capability building. And the most important capability building I see is in this area. Thank you.
Any more questions?
Harry, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2012 IA Summit. The IA Summit podcasts are sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS12.